Hey there! Thanks for tuning in to the special Wednesday question and answer segment of the Deprogram Show with Ted Rall. That's me and Jamarl Thomas. That's him. We are here normally Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. But today's a Wednesday, and every Monday and Wednesday at 12 noon, we take your questions about anything and everything that's on your mind. So if you're watching live on YouTube or Rumble, thank you very much, first of all, for supporting the show and for tuning in and watching. We appreciate you. And please go ahead and put your questions in the live chat. Producer Robbie West, that's him right there. He will take your he will feed your questions and comments up to us. Priorities will go to the Super Chats and the Rumble Rants, but we will try to get to everybody's comments and questions. As we were saying earlier, we'll talk about politics, we'll talk about the news of the day, history, personal questions. If you want advice, I've been saying this, I've always wanted to do an advice column. I'd love to do an advice show, relationships, like what to do about your ex, whatever. Anyway, give us a call and we will do our very, very best to accommodate you. Really, and of course, obviously, news analysis is our purview, so don't be shy there. If you have a question for producer Robbie West, go ahead and pipe it in. If you have a question for two or three of us, pipe it in. It's anything goes. It's a free fire zone. Anyway, trying to think what else I need to say about all of this. Robbie, can you think of anything?
Not sure, to be honest with you. I wasn't listening to what you just said. I was filtering through some of the chats. Could you repeat that, please? Because I have a very small brain.
Okay, it's okay. All right, I'll take you out then and let you focus on what you need to be doing. And Robbie will keep things up. Okay, so one residual comment from before, from the very end of today's early morning show, we had a $2 donation from Boring Adventure Videos talking about the what's underneath the new ballroom at the White House. It's apparently a data center underneath. Maybe. I don't know. I do not know at all. Okay, so. All right, Jack Samuels. Did you see Ted Turner just died? Thoughts of his creation of CNN and the now 24-hour news cycle. I didn't know that. This is the first I've heard of it.
I didn't know that either. Interesting.
So he was married.
Only young.
He was married to Jane Fonda. I remember. I'll tell you my CNN story. So CNN is the very first cable news network. That's why I got those initials, right? And I remember my mom and I growing up in Kettering, south of Dayton. It was the late 1970s, and we still had door-to-door salesmen. And a door-to-door salesman came and knocked on our door, and he explained, there's a new thing, and it's coming. It's came to the neighborhood, cable television. And I was like, I'm a teacher. I don't make much money. And he's like, well, you know, you'll be able to watch all of the football games, you know, blah, 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 from across the country. She's like, go. And then he's like, oh, you're going to be, you know, there's going to be all these shows. It's on 24 hours. Unlike back then, broadcast television, which went off the air at 11 p.m. or 12 p.m. or 1 in the morning. She's like, yeah. Not up that late. Go. Then he goes, and there's news 24 hours a day. And she's like, what? He's like, yeah, it's like, it's you know, there's going to be news constantly from around the world all the time. Not just at 6:30 at night, not just the Today Show, all the time. And she's like, she was a huge news junkie, subscribed to Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, French newspapers. You know, we went to the out-of-town newsstand in downtown Dayton to get out-of-town papers. She was like, done. I'm in. And I think that, to me, that was like it was a moment, you know, something big has just happened. Like this is going to change everything. CNN didn't have competition really of any kind of meaningful way for 15 years. Right. I mean, basically they had the space all to themselves until I believe Fox was first and then MSNBC came in later. And Fox was like, oh, we're going to counterbalance CNN. But, I mean, he was a massive pioneer. And obviously he didn't do it by himself. But Ted Turner was a big deal. He was a visionary. You know, I mean, I don't think it's possible to overstate his importance in the media landscape. And the 24/7 news cycle has done some good things and it's some bad things. I mean, the bad thing that's done is it's given us the impression that, like, society is constantly collapsing everywhere. You know, look, here's this fire in Kansas City. Oh, and at the same time, here's this shooting in Seattle. And at the same time, so you get this sense of total paranoia. But on the other hand, you can have a story that would just be a Cincinnati story that could be a really fucking interesting story. And now it can be a national story. And right. And that's not a bad thing. So I don't know. Thoughts?
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, I agree with you. Like, I think the issue is that it's monetized news, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, I guess it's not about the value of news, if that makes sense. Sometimes it is. But you also, within the context of news that's valuable, you get news that is, you know, bleeds, it leads. Like, the point is to drive a narrative, not necessarily to drive reality. And maybe anywhere you are is where you're at with that. Like, any country that you're in has that cadence or that leaning towards the foreign policy and the policy of the country itself, like the leaders of the country. So, like, for example, if you read, like, Bloomberg, if you read, like, Reuters would take this really passive language about a genocide, which is very weird. Or Bloomberg would say something like, yeah, now that the U.S. has lost, has spent so many munitions in Iran, it can't defend Taiwan. And it's like, dude, you can never defend Taiwan. Right? Like it's this, it's the language that they use that leans into the country itself. But maybe that's anywhere you are. No, man, I agree with you. I think it's the monetized news thing that I think is more degrading, or not degrading. It's more insidious. I'm saying the word wrong. Insidious. Where it's like you're effectively, it's constant. It never stops. It's like there's always something. And as you point out, it's usually something blowing up, something on fire, something that may be a threat, because the point of it is not necessarily news value. The point of it is to get attention. There's a difference in those things. Sometimes they're the same, but oftentimes they're not. So
yeah, totally. All right. Totally. What is the most, Adrian wants to know, what's the most likely conclusion of the SMO? That's the special military operation, as Russia calls the war, the Russo-Ukrainian conflict, and when?
Oh, the win is going to be, I have no idea. I mean, I suspect it's going to go for years. I mean, keep in mind, what Europe wants to do is effectively bleed the Russians with the idea that maybe they'll build their military at some point. But Europe or the U.S. doesn't really care about the Ukrainians. They're willing to basically throw them into a wood chipper for as long as it takes as for them to get prepared. Now, will they get prepared? It's a whole second, you know, that's a secondary question, right? These governments are in debt. There's gas issues at this point, or energy issues. They don't have a united military, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. By the same token, that doesn't mean that they won't chuck every Ukrainian into the fray. So I don't know. I mean, it's, again, I think America is deal adverse or agreement adverse. Russia will have to win this militarily, because I don't think they can really get a deal that they can trust. Even if they do get a deal, I don't quite know what that looks like. It's going to be on their terms. But I don't get the sense that it's going to be like next month or 2 months. I get the sense it's going to go for a while. So that's hard to answer.
Jamal, you and like Mark Slomoda and other people have promoted sort of a Russia hawk kind of approach. Like, maybe they just need to go in harder against the Ukrainians. Do you see that?
Well, Mark doesn't believe that. I don't know if... Actually, Mark does believe it, because Mark thinks it's like they should be going after decision making. So, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So he thinks that it's time to use more force and just go in harder militarily. Do you see the Russians doing that? And why do you think they haven't so far?
Because Jim Jatras, Sloboda, a lot of people have this belief. I have this belief, to be bluntly honest with you. I mean, the idea that Europe can open their airspace to allow attacks on Russian soil is fucking outrageous. And on some level, it's this issue of seriousness where they don't believe you're serious. Now, mind you, this is problematic in and of itself, right? Like, this is problematic on two fronts. A, not believing you're serious or not believing you're credible allows you to be tested, which may make the war that much worse. By the same token, that's the logic that the U.S. is going with, right? Like, well, hey, we don't believe that the Russians will use nukes. Okay, dude, if you put them into a corner, they're liable to use anything. I don't think they've done this because Putin is a pragmatic, rational actor who doesn't want to end up in a third world war. And it's possible also that Putin believes he can get a deal. Meaning, it's one thing, if you're Russia, from my point of view, I think Russia is chasing safety. That for all intents and purposes, I think Putin has taken it his philosophical mission to ensure the safety of Russia for the foreseeable future, even if it means going through a forever war to get to it. I think it's that. I think it's either A, I don't want to escalate in a way that the consequences are unpredictable and unforeseen, especially from the standpoint of getting us into a larger conflict, let's say with NATO. They believe that the war for NATO is going to happen anyway, so they need to get prepared for a larger conflict against all of the Western powers. They may be that. And Putin seems to be pragmatic. And I think his thing is he wants a deal. He wants something in writing where he can take it through the UN Security Council, or for that matter, through Congress, which I don't think he's ever going to be able to do any more than I think Iran was able to get anything through Congress. But he wants a deal, to the chagrin of a lot of people. Because a lot of us think it has to be a military victory. I'll stand by that. Like, it's hard for me to see the U.S. coming to terms for an actual deal. They don't seem to have the capability to do it. I mean, who's the person? Witkoff? And every other week, Donald Trump is litigating through social media? I mean, this stuff is comical. It's comically ridiculous. Oh, Russia better do this. Oh, Iran better do this. Oh, Venezuela better do this. Oh, the Yemenis better do this. Okay, calm down. The reality of it is they are winning a military victory. And I would imagine that obviously the Russians don't want to continue fighting forever. By the same token, NATO is on their doorstep. And in the same way that monster was always going to come to Iran, that monster was always going to come to Russia. They don't have a choice. So, yeah, I think Putin is pragmatic. I think he wants a deal for the preservation of Russia for the foreseeable future. And I don't think he wants to get into this third world war. I mean, for God's sake, they did everything in their power to avoid this war. The Minsk agreements, one and two, the Istanbul agreements. I mean, over and over again. And under no circumstances was the West willing to accept it. From their point of view, pragmatism was weakness. Well, here you are. Here we are.
You're watching Deprogram with Ted Rawlings and Jamar Thomas. If you're just joining us, this is the Ask Us Anything show. So please ask us anything. All right, let's keep on going here. Don't have a question now, but thank you very much for the $10 donation, K. Greg. Okay. Sam Paulciano, 7527. Hey, Ted, you say you're a communist and that you think the janitor should make the same as a CEO. I personally don't think that makes sense. So can you please elaborate so I'm not strawmanning? Be happy to. So here's the thing. The idea that under capitalism that the CEO needs to earn more money than the janitor presupposes that the CEO performs a job that is more vital to society than the janitor. I would argue that probably the opposite is true. If you've ever survived, as I have, a major trash strike in a major city, you know that the janitor is performing an extremely important task. Yep. And if you ever worked for a company where the CEO happened to be out or was fired and not replaced for months, you know that a company can putter along without a CEO quite nicely. But even if you assume that a CEO performs a valuable function, you might also say, well, you're not going to be able to incentivize anyone to be a CEO if you don't pay him well. That's obviously nonsense, because what is an easier job? The janitor or the CEO? The CEO is the easier job. The CEO sits at a desk. The CEO doesn't get sweaty. The CEO doesn't need a shower at the end of the day before he goes out to the bar. The CEO has an easy job. Most of us, if the two jobs earned exactly the same, would prefer to be the CEO. There are tons of jobs where they overpay people. Like, you know, if you told me, oh, you can be like a local NPR host in New York City at WNYC, and we don't, and, you know, I wouldn't need to be paid what, like, Brian Lehrer and some of the hosts who are there on the public dole making $500,000 a year. I don't need that. If you paid me $75,000 or $100,000, I'd be perfectly happy. And I would do just as good a job as if you paid me $500,000. The point is, money isn't the only incentive in society. So, I mean, and then you might say, well, why would someone want to be a janitor then, conversely, as opposed to a CEO? Well, there are people who don't want to prefer to work with their hands. There are people who like doing jobs like that. It's not just a dignity thing. There are people who don't want to sit in a boring conference room talking bullshit with boring people, and they would rather, you know, do work where they see the fruits of their labor manifest themselves with every sweep of the broom. So the point here is that the whole fiction, the construct of the way that we've created wages makes no sense to me at all. And I don't see, and I don't see how you can possibly pay people a different salary without that implying that, say, teachers are not as important as, say, CEOs. Teachers are far more important than CEOs. So that's my answer to that. What do you think, Jamal?
Oh, geez. That's a tough one. I mean, the reason why I say it's a tough one, because look, I understand the point, right? That if there is a stratification in payment by virtue of getting more, you imply that it's more important. And that's not always entirely true. But I don't think our payment system is structured for that reason. I think it's structured just because it can be structured that way, if that makes sense. Like, maybe if I'm the CEO of a company, if I'm owner of a company, I can pay myself more. I can give myself more cash. And if you have a board, the board can say, well, the CEO can technically make us more money. And because the CEO can technically make us more money, if the CEO is any good, then we want to compensate the CEO for being able to make the company more money. Whereas the janitor is performing a vital function, an essential function, but he's not necessarily making decisions that's going to make the company more, if that makes sense. Meaning, I don't think it's governed around what's right. I don't think most things are governed around what's right or even what's vital. It's what earns. Do you agree with me or disagree with that? I mean, because I understand your point. I mean, I used to make this argument that Jeff Bezos can have the greatest ideas in the world. But if he's by himself, he's sitting in a, you know, building by himself. He can't make shit, right? He can't make any money at all without having employees and people and everything else to effectively do the work, do the
labor.
We're
all together, yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't be able to do squat. So this argument that CEOs should be making, you know, have $100 billion is outrageous. The idea that anybody even has $1 billion is kind of mind-blowing.
The idea that Jeff Bezos wouldn't want to get out of bed and build a huge company, even if he only made $100,000 a year.
He would do it.
Yeah, he would, because he loves building a business. That's obviously what drives him.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. There is an incentive for cash, because I think when people get a huge amount of money, it almost becomes, it's not about what you use it for, if that makes sense. It's not about like use value. At that point, it becomes status. It's like, hey, I have $100 billion. Are you going to use it? Nope. It's like, dude, there are people who are hungry, right? Like, it becomes a status issue. It's not even that they wouldn't even miss. I mean, you could take $50 billion and he wouldn't miss it. He wouldn't even know it. Like, right? Now, to be fair, a lot of stuff is in stocks. So take it with a grain of salt. But still, you get my point. No, I get your basic premise. I think, but I don't think it's governed. I mean, it's capitalism. It's not governed around what's right, what's valuable, et cetera. It's governed around how can we make as much cash as possible. And I think this guy can help me make as much cash as possible. So we're going to put that guy in. And that guy's going to get $20 million. He's going to get a golden parachute and all this other stuff. Now, the question becomes, is it right? Hell no. Hell no. And this is where I do agree with you on, like, the financial structure could be different and they would still do the job.
I would look. I've gone through downward mobility as a cartoonist for years, right? I used to have gigs where I could sell. Well, I used to have a cartoon for Fortune magazine every 2 weeks. Easiest cartoon in the world to do. Took me like an hour to draw, maybe half an hour. $900. They translated it into Spanish for the Spanish edition, an extra $900. Then there was a Portuguese edition for Brazil, another $900. $2,700 every 2 weeks for basically 2 hours work a month, right? And then it just started dropping because of the decline of print media, and you know, cartooning just became not as valued. And so I got hired by the Village Voice. My cartoon runs for $500 a week. Then they're like, oh, it's going to be $250. Then they're like, it's going to be $125. Then it's $75. I leave. They fired me. The guy they replaced me with got $50. And ultimately, by the time they closed, they were paying $35. The point is, I didn't draw the cartoons any shittier. But when I was drawing them for $75, they were the same cartoons. I cared about the work every bit as much. And I was just as excited about going to the newsstand and opening up the paper and seeing my work in there. Was I bummed about the lower salary? Yeah, because I live under capitalism and I have bills to pay. But I didn't view it as a reflection of who I was or how much effort I should put into my work or into my labor.
Yeah, but a lot of people do.
They do.
Like, for example, I met this guy once I was in Kenya with my ex-wife. And we were at a casino. And him and I had this long conversation. And he was like, I don't understand why you guys do capitalism in the way that you do it in the States. He was like, you don't pay people enough. The people don't necessarily want to do the jobs because they're not compensated well enough. Meaning they feel like they're being taken advantage of in the context of what you're paying. And he was like, here, we pay our people well. I mean, hell, you can work at McDonald's, make $15, $20 an hour. And the guy has a point. I mean, like, what you're paid in the context of what you do matters.
Sure.
And on some level, it does matter in regards to how dedicated you are to a task. Meaning, if I think you're cheating me, I give a shit about the job. You have to compensate people in a way where those people feel that they're part of the company, or at the very least feel that they're not necessarily being taken advantage of.
Right. There's certain base pay where, yeah. Like if you're working at a store and you're paid like shit, your minimum wage, you know, you're going to steal from that store if you can.
That's what I mean. It matters. Like how you are compensated and whether or not you believe that you're compensated adequately matters. I think it matters. I don't think it's irrelevant to the cause. I mean, granted, there's a difference between somebody making base pay and a CEO making $30 million, right? So put that shit in context. Mm-hmm. CEO thing, I totally agree with you. But you should be compensated for your work, especially if you're doing art and you're doing something that you're coming out of like creative work. Yeah, you should get compensated for it. But I think people should get compensated for their labor in general.
Sorry, Rob, you have some thoughts.
No, I mean, I'm just thinking about this, listening to y'all, and I think that you're both making some good points. And here's how I look at it. Let's just take this show for an example. The two of you are the hosts. Y'all are the talent. Y'all put in the time. You learned your trade. Y'all should be getting paid more than what I make. That's just a statement of fact. There would be no show without Ted Rawl and Jamarl Thomas, because the two of you are very well educated. The two of you have traveled. The two of you have put in the work to become true masters at your craft. Yes. I work in the back end, edit videos and throw stuff up and occasionally have rude opinions. That's all that I bring to the table here, honestly. With the CEO for a company, it's something similar. For example, with a janitor versus a CEO. Now, I'm not talking about Jeff Bezos. I'm talking about just a regular company. Let's just say someone's starting up a coffee shop or something. Who puts in more hours? The person who started the company, that invested, that borrowed the money, that put in the sweat equity to build that business, and 20 years later and has a successful chain of, say, 30 or 40 coffee shops, should that founder, should that CEO be making more than the janitor? The answer is yes. because he or she invested more into it. The company would not exist without what that person did. Also, that person put in the liability factor. There's no guarantee that could have worked. The business could have flopped. Then that person's still on the hook for the loan or everything else. That person has the equity. The janitor doesn't. That's something that needs to be factored in. And I think that's something that people, socialists don't really understand, is what that looks like whenever you're trying to build something from the ground up. When it comes to Jeff Bezos, yeah, I have no problem. I mean, I'm 100% on board with y'all. If you're an oligarch, you should just, I have no problem with you getting just reamed. But just for someone just trying to just going out, busting butt, root hogging or dying, you deserve to earn what you earned because you had the vision, you built the business. Now, that being said, you should pay your people well so that way you keep them. Work has to be rewarded. Loyalty has to be rewarded. You got to have mobility and you got to have a reason for someone to stay there. But to say that the janitor should make as much as the founder of that company, no, that's not the case at all, because the janitor at the end of the day didn't build it and did not have the liability that that founder had.
All right, let's move on with from there. From a quirky question from Manchild. If the two of you started a band to tour the country, what would the name be? And he was definitely hogging the tour bus microwave.
The tour bus microwave. Wow, that's weird. Okay, what would the name be? I don't know, Ted. You guys started the program, so I'm gonna let you.
I'm gonna pass it over to you. I'm terrible with titles. It's one of my weak points. Whenever I have a book coming out, I always reach out to my brain trust, my friends and family, to ask them for suggestions. So I have come up with a few good ones, but for the most part, not really. I will say, okay, so Jello Biafra, the lead singer of the Dead Kennedys, no longer a member of the Dead Kennedys, weirdly and strangely, they're out touring without him, which makes no sense at all. Anyway, Jello Biafra, he had a long stand-up, what is it called? Oral, blah, 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 just stand-up talking kind of thing. And one of his bits was about band names. And of course, it was band names in punk. And of course, this dates the story. But one of the best ones that he came up with, because it was so bad, was like heavy metal band. You have to picture like the logo, like Kiss, with like the drop shadow and the sparks flying up. And it was like Mondale. I vote for Mondale.
Mondale.
I like
you being a politician.
Yeah, exactly, because it's so bad. It's so bad. You remember the band Heaven?
It's 17? Like Bob Dole.
Heaven 17 from the 80s. Their big hit was "Let." What was it? Oh my God, "Let It" something. Anyway.
Leonard Stein.
They were a spinoff band from the Human League. Anyway, the Heaven 17, where they got the name, it's very obscure, but they got it from Clockwork Orange. At one point, like, someone walks into the record store and is like, "Oh, do you have the new Heaven 17?" And it's a fictional name, and they lifted it from that. I thought that was so cool, and so that's why I'm like, hat tip to Jello Biafra, Mondale.
That's a okay.
Like I said, I'm bad at titles.
Yeah, I go with Mondale. I, that's a hard one because that's one person can't make that. If it's a team, it's kind of hard. I don't know something about being on the political outskirts, something like that. Like, yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one.
Here's a good one.
Hold the microwave. I think you'd hold the microwave more. I'm not a big microwave guy.
I don't care about the microwave at all. You guys can have it. What are the best books on the French Revolution, the fascist, and Nazi years?
Oh, The Fascist Annunciates. So there's this really good book by, but see, it's not on the French Revolution, though. I mean, it does sit. The Napoleonic Wars are fascinating. Anthony Bieber has a book on, he goes from basically the Spanish Revolution or the Spanish Civil War, and then moves into the Second World War. But it's not on the French Revolution. I'm not sure. You'd be better on this one.
French Revolution, I would recommend starting with the book Citizens. It shows the revolution both from the top and from the bottom, which is always like my favorite approach. That I think it's kind of like if you've read nothing, it's one of those books like if you've read nothing else on this topic, this would be the one. For Nazism, even though it is really dated at this point because there's been so much new research, I would still have to say the gold standard is William Schar's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Right there.
If you read only one book, right, it tells you the whole story. It explains the whole thing. Ian Kershaw's trilogy on Adolf Hitler is to die. Also to die is Alan Bullock's comparative biography of Stalin and Hitler, just called Hitler and Stalin. He's a British historian, and basically, you know, they weren't the same age, but he compares them by age. So like ages 20 to 30, ages 30 to 40, like that. Fucking amazing. One of the weirdest things is there's photos in the middle. You know how like there's the little signature of photos in the older books? And one of them is the first grade photo, class photo of Hitler and Stalin. And each of them is positioned in the same position in their respective classes, just to the right of the center of the back row. And they both have like their arms crossed, and they both kind of have this sort of like snotty, bored expression. It's fucking incredible. So the parallels are pretty cool. Italian fascism, I would argue, there is no truly great book written about it. And so therefore, I'm not going to make a recommendation. There's any numbers of great books on Vichy France that I could recommend. And I think Vichy is really important because it's about what happens in a represented in a society with a history of liberal democracy when those systems fail. Right-wing fascism comes to power, and you have a clear choice between surviving or waiting or resisting or collaborating. And what do you do? And it defines you and what kind of person you are and what nation you're going to live in. So it's a, to me, that's a really interesting thing.
Another good one is German Way of War. Whitley Strieber's book is really, really good. The German Way of War is a really good one. What is the guy's name? The architect. He had a really good book, even though a lot of the stuff is, I mean, he's lying in some of the book, but it's called, what was Hitler's architect? The one that was...
Oh, Albert Speer.
Albert Speer, right. Speer's book is fantastic.
Inside the Third Reich. There's also, for people who are not in the mood to read the book, although it's a great book, there's a movie with Rutger Hauer playing Speer. Really? About 4.5-5 hours long, maybe longer. Fucking great.
Speer lied a lot in that book, though. Speer lied a lot in that book. Like, there's a scene where he's like, I went to Hitler, and I explained to him that I lied to him about so-and-so. That never happened. Like, there are elements of the book that never happened. But the book is good, though. It's this kind of internal look at Hitler. It's very strange.
Like, and the people around him.
Yeah. It's very weird because it's like, we see Hitler as this kind of...
Like, oh, I get like what Goebbels was like, you know?
Yeah, but it's creepy. Like, it's just very creepy. Willy Schreiber, The German Way of War, Anthony Bieber's book.
While he was interned at Spandau Prison for 20 years, and it was snuck out in bits and pieces of scrap of toilet paper and stuff by his lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that book was good. Now, there are a few books on Nazi Germany that are really, really good. There's one by, what is the guy named? Stephen Cobley, something like that. He wrote the book on Stalin. He wrote a three-piece biopic on Stalin. And it's the first one is kind of like how Soviet Union was looking at Germany saying, hey, there's a problem. It's like there's a problem over there. This is, you know, this is fucking outrageous. I can't believe nobody's paying attention to this. And by the time they got to the second book, you get into the war, if I'm not mistaken. Like, meaning he does this three-piece book on Stalin. And of course, book is looking at the war and looking at what's happening in Germany from the Russian perspective, Soviet perspective.
Grabbing my books. So
less, I know less about
also not to be, there's also the three volume, the trilogy by Richard Evans about it's the Third Reich at war, the Third Reich in power, the rise to power. This is my favorite book about Italian fascism. It's really great. Yep. And speaking of Albert Speer, as along
with
Third Reich, this is Spandau is amazing too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Such dorks. Okay. this is
what's funny. I got old man on my phone. Like, I could just be like, okay, what's
good? Sneaker Dad, thanks so much for the $20. Jamarl dresses like a CEO. Ted and Robbie dress like janitors. Send us more 20s and we'll dress better.
I'll sell my show.
Is a more educated population a good thing or a less educated population? I've got to go better educated is better. Yeah.
Depends. So it depends on whether or not there are opportunities for the people who are highly educated. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they're going to...
Well, there's educated and there's credentialed, and they're not the same thing. And
True.
Like Robbie is extremely well educated and not well credentialed. You know what I mean? Right? Is that fair to say?
Well, the way I look at it is that you have educated people and then you have intelligent people. I mean, you can have, you have plenty of degrees, but thermometers have degrees too. And where do you put them? I mean, there's that. I mean, an educated population does not mean it's an intelligent one.
True. Yeah. I mean, it depends on what you mean by educated, I suppose. No, I understand where you're coming from, Robbie.
Well, like, for example... I mean,
well-rounded, well-read, you know, someone who knows a lot.
Yeah. I mean, the last grade of school that I completed was seventh grade in middle school. I'd never been to high school. And so, I mean, it's just.
Really?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, my grandfather taught me how to read using the King James Bible. And it was, my dad was, he was really abusive and ended up leaving home when I was, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old. I was homeless till I was like 18 or 19 years old. And just lived out in the woods and just do whatever it is I had to do. My grandfather taught me how to read, and then I would go to the library and just study. And I have very, very little formal education. My shadow has never graced the door of a college, never. Wow. And so it just comes down to drive, stubbornness, and this desire just to be more than what people, more than the box that people try to put you into. And I think that's what you need is, you know, you got to have an educated population. That's one of the reasons why I think that immigration is such a problem here, because as long as you can import educated people from around the world, there's no need for the government then to educate the population here at home. Right. And that does a disservice to everyone. That's fundamental to everything. That being said, a lot of companies, they require degrees because IQ tests are illegal. And so they try to use a degree to try and make it seem like, well, we're going to hire the best and the brightest. That's not necessarily the truth. They're hiring people on the assumption that more degrees means that you're smarter.
By the way, there was a police department in Connecticut not that long ago. Ooh, a big bug just flew in. It's a stink bug. Awesome. A Connecticut police department was giving their applicants IQ tests, and what they were doing is rejecting the highest intelligent applicants. And this case, he sued and went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the police department was within its rights to not hire people for being too intelligent.
We want you to follow orders, not think about this stuff.
Kind of amazing.
It's like, think less. Think less. Do your job.
Oh, actually, okay, so Stormborn, this is for you, JT. Who is your favorite Real Housewives franchise and why? I love the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City as they are fun and very messy.
Beverly Hills and Potomac. Oh, Beverly Hills and Potomac. So when I was in a hospital, there was nothing else to watch. And Bravo runs those things in like rotation. And so it's like you're sitting there, you're feeling miserable and crummy, and you're watching it, you're watching it. And the next thing you know, you're like, you're hooked. It's like a drug. Now, the reason why I like it is because it's taught me so much. Like, and that sounds very weird when I tell people that. I've learned so much. Like, how people relate to each other. Like, this notion of being transparent and being able to communicate feelings. Because a lot of stuff they do, I would be like, God, that's so weak. I would never say that. And then I think to myself, but why is it weak? Why wouldn't you say that? Like, why wouldn't you have that conversation as opposed to just kind of cutting people off, like to have the fight? You may be able to preserve a friendship, right? The other thing was watching women through divorce. That was fascinating considering I was divorced, right? But I can only see it from my perspective. Right. And you're looking at like Cal or you're looking at Dorit and they're losing their fucking minds. Like when you're looking at them, they are like, on, like to call it on edge is a second is beyond the pale, right? The men are out there having fun and partying. They're in somewhere hooking up with chicks half their age. Like they're doing that stuff. And the women are like just losing their shit with each other, which is fascinating to me. And it made me feel some kind of way about it. Like in looking at it and looking at how they process this stuff. I don't know. I was fascinated by it. I just learned a lot about how people interact. And I don't mean the overly dramatic stuff. Take out the fights and the drama. The core concerns of divorce, friendships, how to preserve friendships, the willingness to be able to have a fight and a conversation and still retain, you know, a certain degree of flexibility. Yeah, it's fascinating to me because that's not the way I operate. Like that's not the way I operate. And so for me, I was like, all right, there are things where you need to housewife.
That's not the way you operate. What do you do? Like if you have the conflict, you just walk away or?
It depends on the person. It depends on the conflict. Family members, obviously, are, you know, you're stuck with family members. I don't talk to my exes. That was something else that I learned. It's like, holy shit, people co-parent. They still talk to their exes. They're still friends. Sure. And I was like, wow, that's a revelation. I didn't know people did. Well, I knew people did that, but I just didn't know how that worked. And yeah, there are some people, I mean, even during the show, right? Like, well, there are certain people I just stopped talking to. Where it's like, okay, I'm annoyed in this situation. You've fucked me over really much. I'm out. I don't want to talk to you anymore. And they would hit me over and over again, like, hey, what's wrong? It's like, dude, you should know what's wrong, right? Same thing with, there was another person who flipped out on my show and I never talked to her again. And she apologized and I still never responded. It's like, dude, my show is important. You fucked over my show. Now, after Housewives, I was like, okay, you got to do better at this. And I contacted those people year later, but still, I was like, hey, you doing okay?
Wow.
I was like, housewife some shit out. I mean, like, even with family, I remember I was talking to my aunt and they were having like this disagreement within the family. And I was like, okay, this is toxic. Time to housewife this shit out. That's how about it. That did not go well. That went about as well as it does on Housewives.
Gotcha. All right. Got a question for Robbie.
You did.
Robbie, you mentioned you lost a contract because you refused to back down about Israel. Would you be willing to talk about that?
Interesting. Yeah. So it was a client of mine, a Christian Zionist, and y'all probably noticed I have some strong feelings about God's chosen people and the little reprobate state that's right there on the eastern bank of the Mediterranean. And he said that he felt that I was being incredibly anti-Semitic, that I was being hateful, that I was going against God's plan, and that I was being anti-Christian and inviting God's judgment on myself and on my family by not blessing the seed of Abraham. And he demanded that I issue a formal apology. To which case I said, sir, I believe that you are an apostate. You are not a Christian. You are an idolater. You are a heretic. And at best, you're a wolf in sheep's clothing. And at worst, you are an absolute disgusting human being. And he said, so then do you want my contract or no? And I promptly told him, you can shove the contract up your ass. I do not want it.
Well, I will say, I think it's very, I'm going to quote a boss who was not a good boss, but she did say something I never forgot. She said that we are defined more by the work that we refuse to do than the work that we agree to do. And I always thought that was true, and not just the work, like whatever, what we refused, what's our limit? What are we not willing to do? Like, you know, if someone offered you $5 million a year to do PR for the IDF, you know, you really want and could use $5 million a year. Who couldn't? But, you know, could you do it? Would that be a line in the sand? It would be for me. I couldn't do it.
But I'm not a whore. I will not do it. I will not sell myself. I will not sell my integrity. I will not sell my conscience. And I will not betray my God for you and your filthy money. I will not do it. I might not know where my next meal is coming from. I've ate out dumpsters before. By God, I'll do it again. You can keep it.
Yeah.
I don't need you. I don't want you. The Lord Jesus Christ, as my witness, knows that I want nothing more than for these wars to end. And but the best way for these wars to end is for Israel to stop, to cease to exist as the apostate, as the blight on this earth that it is. It is a disgusting, satanic, antichrist state. And if that makes me anti-Semitic, if you think that makes me a racist, then by all means, from the bottom of my heart, screw you. I am against the murder of innocent people. And I'm against my tax dollars being used to murder innocent people. And if you think that makes me a bad Christian, kiss my hairy white ass.
Which is going to be licked soon, I hear.
No, my ass will never be licked.
That's a callback to TMI. Okay, so Robbie, stay right here because you guys should answer this. Okay, do you guys have any first time talking here? Do you guys like any video games? If so, what's your favorite game? Also, do you guys like Pokemon? And if so, who's your favorite? I'm going to make a team around it.
So Ted, you go first because I know what the answer is.
I love Xbox.
I don't play video games at all. But when I did, it was back in the 70s and 80s, and I played games like Galaga and Asteroids.
In that reason,
super OG. I just it's not like I was against it. I think I just went to college, and there were I wasn't hanging out at the Dayton Mall. There were no arcades, and there was no video. Back then, to go to play video games in the 80s in New York City, you had to go to Times Square and go to a video arcade place. And frankly, if you were willing to stand there, you're probably going to get like stabbed or robbed or something. It was dangerous. And it's like, I'm not going to go stand there and like someone's going to pickpocket me. Like, fuck that. So I just wasn't addicted to it. I just didn't. It was just like, I like video games, but I'm not. It's not like something I think about my glass of wine at the end of the day. Like, I look forward to it. I didn't think about video games that way. You guys should answer this question.
Civilization, XCOM, chess, Pac-Man.
For me, but I run a gaming channel here on Rumble. So Putinbot Gaming, if you want to come by. Yes, Putinbot, because I was a big Trump supporter. And so naturally, like, oh, you're a Putinbot. Therefore, Putinbot Gaming is born. I am the ultimate troll, to quote Ted Rall. Oh, and look at that. There's a spammer. Hold on one second here on Rumble. Nazis everywhere. Congratulations. You, sir, have just been banned.
Here comes the hammer, the fist of God.
Yeah, you just got smashed. But no, I love the Baldur's Gate games. Baldur's Gate 3 is one that I stream a lot on Rumble. I do Mortal Kombat, or currently doing Mortal Kombat 1. I like strategy games. Rome Total War is fantastic. If you like real-time strategy games, you have to figure in military strategy.
What's it called? Road to War?
Rome Total War.
Oh, Rome Total War. Okay.
Yes, it's an oldie. It's like an old 20-year-old game. Fantastic, because you got to manage the economy. You actually control the battles in real time. It's like Civilization if it was actually true military, military strategy. Fantastic games. I'm a big fan of dark fantasy. The darker it is, the more I like it. Just like my women, the darker they are, the more I like them too. And that's just how it goes.
Oh, that's funny. My mom was telling me about a doctor that had apparently an African wife or African American wife, and was like parading her through the office, like, "Here's my black wife," like just proud of her, like just beaming with pride. And it was like, "Yeah, it's the black women in the office that really go to the doctor because that's the only way to get it, get anything from white nurses. Can't get anything."
I'm so torn about that, right? Because sex involves and attraction involve objectification, right? By definition. But on the other hand, it's kind of like those are cringe moments, right? But on the other hand, it's like it does say something. Who we're willing to sleep with talks about, like, you know, our inclusiveness. It's the ultimate in inclusiveness, right? I was talking to a guy who is on the board of a major dating app that we've all heard of. And he said that they'd done studies and they found that black women at that time, this was a long time ago, had the lowest rate of when they reached out to someone, usually a guy, they had the lowest rate of responses of any demographic. And I was like, okay, right there, that's racism, right? That's racism. And people say, like, oh, like, you know, it's not racist to not be attracted to certain races. I'm like, it's the definition of racism. Like,
is it?
That's just like, preference.
It's preference. Like, for example, it's like saying, it's put it this way. I know what it is. It would be like if a guy came to you and said, "Hey Ted, would you do gay porn?" And you said no. And he said, "Okay, that's homophobic. Why can't I put my dick in you?" And you're like, "Dude, what?" You know, like, meaning it's preference. Like, how do you?
Heterosexuality does sort of entail a certain form of homophobia. It does.
Come on, Ted.
You are out of your mind.
But also, it's like preference. Okay, the thing is preference. So I think we all agree that, like, there's like if you're hetero, you're going to be repulsed by, like, you know, having sex with by homosexual sex. You're not going to, right? Or if you're, let's say you're a gay guy, you're going to find women disgusting. You don't want to be around them. You just don't want to have sex with one, right? But it's like. All humans of, let's say, the opposite sex, if you're heterosexual, they're all human beings, right? They're all human beings. And to be like, oh, like, so it's like, I'm not saying like, oh, let's say you're saying, I have found that Belizean women tend not to be my thing. That's not what I'm talking about. I mean, like, oh, hey, Ted, I know a Belizean woman you'd love. I'm like, no, I won't meet her. Why? Oh, because she's Belizean. I don't like Belizean women. That's what I'm talking about. That's racist.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough.
Well, Belizean's not a race. Out
an entire demographic. Look,
rule them out. Like, you can certainly find, like, you know, like, of course, obviously, you might be like, there's a certain body type that tends to do it more for you than another body type. Obviously, or a certain way of dressing, or a certain way of talking, or whatever. Of course. But to have like a blanket statement like, oh, I will absolutely not date someone of this race or whatever, it's like, that's disgusting.
Why? It's a preference.
it's a racist preference is what it is.
Okay, so racism is
a preference of white waspy clubs to not have Jews. No. It's an anti-Semitic preference.
Okay, hold on, Ted. I'm going to push back just a little bit because you're so far off the reservation here. The Cowboys are going to come chase you down.
First time ever, Robbie.
So, for example, would y'all agree that I'm a pasty white guy? JT, you go first. Am I a pasty white dude or not?
You're a white guy. I don't know what pasty is. You're a white guy.
Okay,
so, I've seen pastier.
So, I don't like white women. I like black women. That does not mean I'm racist against white women. The reason that I prefer black women is, one, I find them more attractive. And also, when they get older, they don't raise it up like white women do. Black don't crack, baby. That's just a fact of life, okay? I mean, white people and Filipinos are the same. You hit 30 and you turn to a prune. You shrivel and you're done.
You want a car that'll go 300,000 miles is what you're
correct.
Saying.
And so I've been with the same car now for 20 years. God willing, I'll be with her for another 20 to 30. You know, that's the plan. Racism means that you believe that one race is genetically superior to another. It has nothing to do with sexual preference or the marketplace of sex in the marketplace of dating. Those are two very different things.
Robin,
let's say
your wife left you, and then okay. Are you saying you would not ever consider dating a white chick under any circumstance?
I'm just not attracted to them. Completely That's honest.
So answer my question. Yay or nay?
No. I'm not attracted to them.
I do. Stop dating white guys.
I am not attracted to them. Listen, I would rather go find myself an illegal immigrant from Guatemala than be with some white chick.
Are you telling me of all the white women on this planet, your thing is like,
come on, you're saying there's not one like white chick?
Not one.
You're asking me for my preference.
Even Hillary Clinton, you wouldn't.
No.
Scarlett Johansson.
No, I don't know who that is. Oh, you mean from Gone with the Wind?
No, the actress in Marvel, the one that plays Black Widow. She's gorgeous.
She's gorgeous.
Yeah, sure. For like three more years, then she just has to get a facelift and stuff. Yeah, no thanks. Sweeney, not interested.
Sydney Sweeney, the one in the jeans.
She's that woman. That girl is fugly as hell.
Oh, you're out of your goddamn mind, Robbie.
I am not out of my mind. I'm telling you, she'll look okay in a dark room. She has a great body. Her face looks like she got hit in the face of the board.
I'm shocked, Robbie.
Well, I'm kind of between you guys about her.
No, I'm very good at shocking
her
people.
Face isn't that
I'm being honest.
Her face is not that great. It's true.
I think she is gorgeous. In fact, I think her face is just breathtaking.
Listen, she has a great figure.
It's something about her look that does it for me. I don't know. I mean, I am equal opportunity on this stuff. I've been all around the world, and I've found women to be attractive all over the place.
I think when you travel, you realize that like there's just so much variety here.
Indonesia, Malaysia. I mean, all these places. I mean, it's just I don't know.
Now, tell you who I think the country I think that has the most beautiful women. Like, if I was single, I'd 100% want to go there like tomorrow and just stay there until I get hitched. It had to be Kazakh women. I think they are gorgeous. They've got to be the most beautiful women on the planet.
Okay. What are Kazakh women?
But, I mean, I
don't have a mental image. But, I mean, that seems so random.
Well, they're just, I mean, they just have the olive complexion or kind of the mongoloid. They're just all kind of mixed up. They're right there on the invasion paths. It's just, they're a bit of everything. It's just like when I was in Brazil. The most beautiful woman I ever met in my life had natural blonde hair, the greenest eyes ever, and JT, her skin was as dark as yours.
Cultural commingling.
Beautiful woman.
Cultural commingling makes for the prettiest girls, right?
So, yeah, for sure.
So you know, therefore,
I would not go fishing for a beautiful bride in Germany.
Invasions and illegal immigration and migrant movements, therefore, are good for sexual attractiveness. So you're on team migration, is what you're saying.
Once we fix our problems here at home and we have a functioning economy where workers are able to pay their bills and inflation is no longer a problem, sure. But you got to take care of your own. You got to take care of your home folks first. And 30% of the population is black. I have a good pool to go fishing from.
One more question, guys. Sam Paulson, thanks so much for the $20 donation. Very generous, much appreciated. Since if most billionaires sold any stock, the price of that stock would go down, and they can't actually be worth that amount. Who do you all think is the actual richest person or family in the world? Rothschilds, Rockefellers, etc.
Oh, the Rothschilds.
That's a question.
The Rothschilds for sure. They have generational dynastic wealth.
Yeah.
And they also profited by double dealing and financing governments of both sides in multiple European wars, including World War I. There's a reason why Lord Balfour made the agreement with Lord Rothschild. It's because the skids were sufficiently greased. That's why Trump's in bed with Netanyahu right now. Those skids are sufficiently greased too. The Rothschilds, they're all up in there.
Yeah, I mean, you might be right. I don't know. That's a hard question to answer. I mean, because you're right. Like, the moment that Musk sells the stocks, he's, you know. Yeah, I don't know. I'll go with the Rothschilds, too. But not because I know, but just because I accept the argument, right? Even though I don't know.
All right, guys. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I'm going to assume someone's alarm is going off there. It's not mine.
It's not mine.
That mine?
What? That's Trent's.
Trent. Oh, that was Trent.
Background.
Trent! How dare you?
There he is. Trent, turn off your... I'm turning off his sound here. Oh, I can't do it. All right, well, with that...
Wild.
Hilarious. Trent, explain yourself. Okay, whatever. All right. With that, thanks everyone for tuning in to the Q&A show. Deprogram will be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And see you then. Bye.
Bye-bye, guys. Be safe.